Accession number 2, 8, 9, 3, 5, reel 2.
Verse 5, reel 2. When you first arrived at the airfield, were you given a familiarisation flight?
Not straight away, no. What I recall of this place was that we did ground instruction, certainly for at least a week. I remember particularly in the very early stages, the instructor standing up on the platform said something to this effect: some of you are going to fail this course, some of you will be dead, and so forth. And this sort of pulled one up sharply, and I've often thought about the wisdom of telling us that, and I realize he was absolutely right, because he was bringing home to us the seriousness of what we were about to do, and it is better to be warned at the beginning.
The ground instruction in that first week, what did that entail? What were the subjects they were...
It was aerodynamics, anything to do with the aircraft itself. I can't be too specific. I know that it was a preparation for the machine and for cross-country navigation. Yes.
What kind of degree of navigation had you done to that point? Because you mentioned a little bit in the basic training, but I imagine...
Well, at St. Vincent we only did sea navigation. It was when we got to this next place that we did aerial navigation, a very different cup of tea.
How did the two differ?
Sea navigation, you have a chart and you can plot things, you have a lot of information at your disposal. You can watch what you're doing all the time. It's a rather different state of affairs, isn't it? But when it comes to the air, it's not so easy to plot, particularly if you're a pilot and you've got all your hands occupied.
Once you'd done the initial ground training there, would that be right in saying it's really kind of the theory of flight?
It was the theory of flight. Yes, that is absolutely correct. It's the theory of flight. Meteorology, of course, map reading, things of that kind. Map reading, central, of course. You know, I'm having to rethink things which I haven't thought about for 60 years.
So at that stage, after the ground training, would you then have been given a familiarisation flight?
Yes, then one went up with an instructor, and it was merely a take-off, a quick turn around the airfield, a few turns, and then down again. I think it took me about 7 hours to go solo. So in that time, one was doing... take-off, circuit and landing. And it is the stage when the first of the pupils fail, because they cannot judge height. The Tiger Moth was a very sensitive little machine, very sensible training aircraft. On the landing approach, if you were to stall it, you would be in trouble. And I think a number of people did lose their lives that way. And it's a very delicate lander. But that said, once in the air, extremely maneuverable, pleasant thing to fly. I don't know how many marks there were of the Tiger Moth, but the one that we trained on, one could put it on its back and stay there, which is unusual.
Could you just give me a little visual description of the Tiger Moth, what it looked like?
Well, it was an open cockpit, a little open cockpit aircraft, with, can't remember if one sat in the front or the back. it was a very delicate machine when landing and taking off. That I do recall. But that when once in the air, it could be thrown around, you could do 10 spins and come out perfectly on a pre-selected heading, selected in the mind, I should say. You know you want to come out pointing at that factory over there, so you do your 10 and then come out and find a factory in front of you with luck. An example of a good rate of turn in an aircraft is to hold it so steady that when you have done a complete turn, you enter your own pop wash. You feel it in the stick. That shows that you've done a perfect circle. Yes, it's a lovely aeroplane.
Can you describe to me the instrumentation you have on when you were training on the Tiger Moth?
You're asking me, oh my goodness me, the instruments were simple, certainly. I cannot even recall if we had night flying stuff. I'd have to look in my logbook to see if we did any night flying.
Could I take it through a little bit from the earlier point? Obviously, it's the first aircraft that you
were flying. It is.
Could you tell me how you take off in the Tiger Moth?
Yes. You have a tail skid, not a tail wheel. You are subject to crosswinds when taxiing out, which can make it difficult for you. So you're working your rudder quite a lot. I'm talking about taxiing out before you head into wind. You cannot see ahead of you because the nose climbs up fairly sharply away from your cockpit. When the throttle is opened, you feel the machine starting to trundle forward, and suddenly the tail comes up and you've got a view ahead of you. Hold the aircraft down until you read an airspeed which tells you it's safe to gently pull back on the stick and begin your climb out.
And how would you make a turn in it?
Well, you use your turn and bank. If you want to make a turn, staying at one level, it is simply a case of putting on bank, putting on a bit, if you're turning to port, putting on a bit of right rudder to hold so that you balance and the nose doesn't drop. A 45 degree turn is about what you should be aiming for if you want to pick up your vortex.
And coming into land, how do you approach and land the Tiger Moth?
The proper drill is to be on the downwind leg at about 1,000 feet and to learn through experience when to begin your turn in at a steady rate. Now I'm coming to something which is very applicable to the carrier pilot. The landing on an aircraft carrier is a skill, an art, which is acquired through paying attention, being aware of the risks involved. One of which, for example, is that you stall. But we're now talking about landing on an airfield. So you make a descending turn at what should be a steady rate of descent at an airspeed, say 5 knots above the stall, although the RAF used to do a lot higher than that, I think, and learn how to do a flare out. Coming back to the cases where people were failed, it was at this point that they were picked out. They could not judge their height. They would either fly into the ground or hold off at 20 foot, neither of which is the wise thing to do. So your instructors are watching for this, and this is where they pick out the first of the failures.
How do you judge the ground? Did you have any techniques for judging the ground, or is it simply just experience?
you know the procedure to follow. You know that you've got to get the nose up. You want to stop ballooning. Watch a tiger moth land. It'll balloon very easily. But also it'll sink down if you just keep the throttle closed.
You mentioned stalling. What happens when the aircraft stalls?
You drop a wing. Start pointing towards the ground. Don't like that. No.
And another thing for a non-flyer is, you mentioned spinning.
Yes.
How were you instructed in spinning the aircraft and getting out of the spin?
We were taken to a height of 4,000 to 5,000 feet, warned to be strapped in properly, and I'm not talking about the instructor demonstrating. He'd say, "Now you're strapped in properly, and yes, you make jolly well make sure you are in you're an open cockpit after all." And then he will close the throttle, and you notice as you watch you've got a control column as he has, because this is a dual control machine. You notice that he's pulling back on the stick all the time, pulling back, trying to hold the nose on the horizon. On the horizon, and until the stick is right back and the speed has dropped off, the aircraft starts to shake, and suddenly the instructor will kick on rudder. That instantly makes the wing on the rudder side drop, and you find yourself pointing towards the ground and spinning around.
How do you get out of that spin?
You get out of it by putting the stick into central position, rudder central, and stick slightly forward, and it'll come out of its own, on its own.
How did it feel to do that that first time you...
I never got used to it. I never liked spinning. No. There are people that used to go up and do it, spin for fun. I would go up, when told to go up and do spins, I would go and do them, but reluctantly.
You said it was 7 hours before you went solo. What was the procedure for going solo?
You are not told beforehand that you might go solo. You're just going up once again with the instructor, who will put you through your paces, aerobatics. Force landing. Things of that nature. And if you've done all that correctly, you may find he suddenly gets out from the back and says, "Okay, it's on your own, go away and do some circuits." And that's it. And then you know you've started.
Does it feel strange at first to be the only person in the aircraft when you're doing a solo?
It took me a few seconds to get used to it. No more.
And how did you feel after having soloed?
I must be a bit thick. I've always thought I was a bit thick, because I never reacted with excitement or jumping around or accomplishing anything, really. I just took it all as it came. I thought, well, this is what you must expect. This is it.
You mentioned a couple of things there that you'd done in the training, though. Was there a lot of emphasis placed on things like forced landing training?
Yes, you had to do that. You had to know how to do that. The instructor would close the throttle and say, "Right, make a landing," and you would carry out this landing to within 100 yards of the point where you were aiming for, and then he'd open the throttle and it would take you off again. Never carry it out full all the way. But one had to be able to do that and judge. I have only done it once all the way. Then I did it deliberately. It was a cold day, it was in a swordfish, and I thought, well, I must practice this. I'm not often over land, and I saw an airfield and I did it. Closed the throttle, cold day, didn't tell the crew in the back, landed on the grass, went to open the open up, and nothing happened. Screw stopped. Crew got out of the back, walked away, leaving me to get the handle out of the back, shove it in the hole up forward, wind, And I did all the necessary things, bar one. I'd forgotten to put the handbrake on. And I got the aircraft started, and it started moving rather fast after the people had climbed out of the aircraft. Took me a while to get it back inside the aircraft. But that's another story.
You mentioned also aerobatics. What type of aerobatics would you be practicing? To what level at that stage?
Rolls, loops, roll off the top. Those are the three that I remember particularly, yes. Rolls, port, starboard, looping, yes, rolling off the top.
Given you explained that the swordfish was quite a delicate to handle, was it easy to do those types of things?
You have asked me about aerobatics. I must explain to you that the swordfish was not for aerobatics, although I have seen the swordfish looped. It shouldn't be. It's not stressed for that.
What about the tiger moth, though? Was the tiger moth?
The tiger moth was designed for throwing around, really learning how to handle an aircraft. And I must tell you, I was never a good pilot. I was never a natural one. That's my feeling, anyway. I learned how to fly airplanes because one had to.
Are there people who were natural pilots as you saw them on the course?
Yes. Oh, yes, one always saw them. Yes, they took to it. Loved it. I was not the sort of man that could respond to the instructor who said, oh, you see that Spitfire over there? Do you want to go take the spin? I'd say, no, thank you very much. Nobody ever asked me. Correction. I was asked a question like that once. I took a swordfish to an airfield near Glasgow. I was going on leave. And I parked next to an American Thunderbolt fighter. And out of the hangar came first of all the RAF, and they walked around the swordfish and just shook their heads. They didn't say anything, they just walked around it and then shook their heads and went back inside the hangar. They were followed by some Americans who came out, including a young officer. The Americans started poking at the swordfish, the canvas and so forth, so saying things like, geez, goodness knows what else. And the officer came up to me and said, you going anywhere? I said, yes, I'm going anywhere. He pointed to the Thunderbolt and said, do you want to take that? He might have asked me, did I want to go to the moon? No, thank you.
Equally, those people who were natural pilots, as you said, and there were people like yourself who were learning to fly, and were there people at that stage, because you mentioned earlier that there were the one or two people who weren't, who just couldn't get the hang of flying?
Yes. They couldn't get the hang of flying, and they went on to other things. I don't know the percentage of dropouts in an average course, but I think it was fairly considerable. And incidentally, there's always somebody dead before the initial training's over.
Is that a sobering thing when obviously one...
Sobering?
Is it a sobering feeling when obviously one member of the course is...
I don't recall at any stage during the war anybody commenting much when somebody was killed.
Was it seen as part and parcel, really?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Once you'd soloed, was there any change in the pattern of the training? Did you do anything that you hadn't done prior to soloing?
Yes, I went on to navigation exercises. In other words, being trusted to go fly to another airfield, land, fuel, and come back, find your way, map reading and so forth. You know the expression Baedekering. Baedekering is taken, named after the German guidebook, essentially reading the names on railway station platforms.
With that type of navigation in the cross country, then a lot of it's involved in map reading and visual reference.
Map reading and steering a set course beforehand. You've done your homework supposedly before you leave. You know the wind direction, you know the wind speed, you know the weather, and you therefore you have plotted off on your chart your course and the rest of it. You carry a chart with you, and you watch to see what's happening. You're almost certain to be crabbing. The course is a crabbed one, unless you're dead into wind or dead downwind. But you've got to crab if you're to maintain a steady heading.
You mentioned the term crabbing. What does that mean exactly?
Well, if I'm... you are... If you were to plot the course that you have flown with a model, you'd see that you're not... That you're going... It's difficult. If you think of the effect of wind, it is trying to blow you off your course. So you've got to alter your aircraft heading to compensate. You head into it. So you're heading up like that.
So it's almost a constant readjustment into the wind, is it, crabbing?
You are making allowances for the wind. But you've done that theoretically before you even take off. You know that you're going from A to B on such... It is... on the map, it's such and such a heading, but the wind is coming from another heading, and you have got to compensate for that. Therefore, you know, you've got to adjust so that your actual track, is the correct shortest distance between two points. Oh, you're taking me back to school again.
So once you've done your cross countries. Is there any other things that you would practice at that stage?
I suppose there must have been, but I can't remember. Work at ground school can always continue. You didn't leave the classroom and then go into the air and do nothing else. The two went together. In fact, as right the way through training, as I recall, there was a certain amount of ground school.
What was the next move then after you'd done your elementary flying training? Was it then a posting?
Then went from the EFTS to the SFTS. That's I'm trying to remember what the S stood for. Anyway, it was Canada at Kingston, Ontario, and the aircraft was the Harvard.
How did you get from Great Britain to Canada?
I went. We were still in sailor suits, and therefore required to do stand duties aboard the liner that we took us across, which I think the ship was the Montrose. I remember my duty was above the bridge with a pair of binoculars. Watching for doing what, in fact, one was going to be doing for the next few years, looking for submarines.
Did you sail in convoy, or was it
in convoy? Yes, with a battleship.
How long did it take to get across to Canada?
I can't remember. I suppose about 10 days, something like that.
And you arrived in Canada. Did you go straight to Kingston at that stage?
Yes. Well, virtually, we stop over at a place called Moncton, which is in New Brunswick. There for 2 or 3 days. I think that's where they sorted us all out. And then we proceeded without any further stops via Montreal to Kingston.
You'd arrived in February of 42?
Well, I'll have to look at this. Yes, that's right, 1st of February 42.
What was the weather like when you arrived in?
Snowy. Very snowy. Crisp. Different world. Lights on at night. Everybody had food. Oh yes, fairyland.
And how did the training start with the Harvard? Was it the same procedure?
Same procedure, and again, this time under the RCAF. Otherwise, yes, the same procedures, same sort of things, but in a more advanced fashion, if you like. I'd have to look at my logbook to see some of the description of some of the exercises one carried out, but there was an awful lot of cross-country work. In other words, learning to understand one's instruments and to use them properly. Because what you need to appreciate with a carrier pilot such as he who is on anti-submarine work, he is going to spend most of his life out of sight of land, out of sight of the ship, sitting behind a single engine for 2 to 3 hours at a time, relying on a man sitting behind him with a fairly elementary chart board, giving you instructions to steer such and such a heading at, to maintain such and such a speed. And you've got to do it, because if you don't, you're not only letting the chap behind you down, you may be losing the lot of you. So, yes, learning one's instruments, controlling your heading. I think the naval people became very, very good at flying exact instructions, because the lives depended on. It's not like overland going from A to B, etc. If you get lost, you can put down somewhere, or it's not all that serious unless it's the weather that is also forcing you into trouble. But at sea, that is your life, and you've got to know exactly what your machine is doing.
How did the cross countries differ, though, while you were in Canada from the ones that you...
Well, there's snow on the ground. It's a different setup. Where there as well, we went into night flying. Personally, I liked night flying, and I think that those who liked night flying, from the word go, possibly derived a sense of comfort from being shut off from the realities. It's a delusion. It's a delusion. And I think we suspected that it was a delusion. But I know that I was quite comfortable sitting in this black cocoon with nothing but a few instruments in front of me.
How had you learnt to night fly? What was the procedure for learning to night fly? Because obviously it's very different, isn't it, from having...
Well, quite honestly, I don't know, except I recall that what you began with an instructor, and he'd take you through your paces and eventually say, well, off you go. Of course, the thing, again, with learning something on an... getting to the stage is your landings, particularly at night. A night landing is quite an experience. By the time you've got to the Harvard, though, you ought to be pretty well aware of what to expect. The little fears that may crop up in the mind on the approach. Yes, very interesting. And of course, bear in mind that once again, we are going to have to do this at night on a carrier. And that cat is not sitting still.
So when you were doing that, you say little fears that would crop up. What were you thinking of when you had to come in and do a landing at night? How was it?
Well, in the case of the Harvard, ground looping. The Harvard was had a tendency, if you didn't land reasonably well, to suddenly go careering off to port or starboard and do a ground loop. Uncomfortable sensation. Personally, I never did it myself, but I'm told it's not a comfortable sensation.
And landing at night, what kind of references do you have on the runway? Is it marked?
Only lights, flare lights. I can't remember what they were, whether they were literally flares or fixed ones. I think they were flares, actually, at Kingston. So long ago, that. Yes, and you only see one set. Just a few lights. Quite honestly, I don't know how I ever mastered it, but just did.